Hello, and welcome to the Critical Voter Podcast. My name is Jonathan Haber. We got a fair amount of ground to cover before this week's guest, Jay Heinrichs, author of Thank You for Arguing, joins us to talk about the rhetoric of the campaign. So let's jump right in. First off, in an effort to continue applying the critical thinking tools we've been discussing to various aspects of the campaign, I want to show you how argument maps, especially ones created using the Toulmin model I discussed back in episode 4, can help you clarify and understand an argument. And since those argument maps really need to be seen to be understood, this lesson will be appearing on the Critical Voter blog over the next few days. Meanwhile, here on the podcast, I'd like to continue last week's discussion of how to understand the first presidential debate in terms of the critical thinking skills you've been studying. The importance of this campaign event became more and more apparent last week as a storyline matured which said Mitt Romney was the clear winner of the debate and that his strong performance in Obama's weak one was a game changer in terms of the dynamic of the race. This is not just a storyline Republicans have been pushing to their own advantage. In fact, concerns about the president's debate performance reached such fevered levels among Obama's supporters that Saturday Night Live was able to capture the phenomenon brilliantly in a parody of a news special on the liberal MSNBC cable network entitled, quote, "The Worst Thing That Ever Happened Anywhere." Given that I live in a particularly blue region of one of the country's bluest states, my experience with this subject consisted of several Democratic friends and acquaintances familiar with this critical voter project, wondering if there might be some rhetorical explanation that could help them understand what happened better than some of the narratives they were getting from traditional news sources. These analyses range from arguments over who could quote or invent more facts per minute to attempts to blame the president's performance on jet lag or altitude sickness. Last week, we took a look at the debate through the lens of a few of the critical thinking tools we've been discussing. For example, a review of logos, pathos, and ethos, Aristotle's three modes of persuasion, as well as how arguments are organized, helped explain why the format of the debate neutralized a number of rhetorical advantages the president enjoys in other sorts of venues. Notably, Obama's frequent use of emotional, pathos-based, and connection ethos-based appeals, coupled with his skilled deployment of linguistic rhetorical devices and mastery of the peroration, the emotional climax to a speech, were all of little use, and in some cases counterproductive, in the context of how the first debate was structured. Beyond those debate mechanics, I'd like to highlight another point that harkens back to the discussion of bias we had way back in episode 2. Specifically, I'd like to talk about how confirmation bias, the tendency to accept information that confirms to pre-existing beliefs while rejecting information that does not fit these existing storylines, can sometimes blow up in our faces, causing harm to the very candidates and causes we claim to champion. In this case, Obama's supporters and Obama himself have created the image of the president as a master persuader, capable of moving and convincing audiences based on the power of his oratory. But because not everyone understands that oratory involves a range of skills, balancing modes of persuasion, organizing an argument effectively, using the right verb tenses, etc., it didn't occur to many people to consider the upcoming debate format in terms of Obama's rhetorical weaknesses, since the assumption was he didn't have any. Similarly, since Romney is not well known for his successful speechmaking, it was assumed that he was going into the debate with significant disadvantages, ignoring the possibility that the debate's format might provide him an opening to use his rhetorical strengths, since again, the assumption was he didn't have any of those. Had Democrats been willing to understand the strengths and weaknesses of both candidates, they might have prepared their man better than they apparently did, anticipating Romney's talking points and having skilled riposte at the ready, for example. And had they been willing to talk openly about the president's limitations as a speaker, or praise his opponent for his rhetorical abilities, they might have been able to use that technique I talked about last week of managing expectations by raising people's expectations of the Republican candidate while lowering them for the president. While it might seem counterintuitive for a campaign to trash their own guy while singing the praises of the enemy, if, before the debate, Obama campaign operatives had successfully raised people's expectations of Romney and lowered them for Obama, then the same performance we saw last week might have been interpreted as a draw, while a stronger performance by the president would have been interpreted as Obama overcoming great obstacles to deliver the debate performance of a lifetime. So how might the president recover in the upcoming debates? Well, as you know, this is a nonpartisan podcast, so any advice that might come out of the critical thinking principles discussed in this show need to be evenly distributed to both parties, presuming campaign apparatchiks or scouring the web for advice. But before getting this advice, I need to introduce a concept that underlies each and every critical thinking subject that's been covered on this podcast so far, the notion of consistency, and the depth the need for consistency is wired into our brains. If you just think about logic, that cornerstone critical thinking skill, The greatest victory you can have over a debate opponent is to prove that their argument ends in a logical contradiction. If we can boil down what they're saying into a syllogism that ends with therefore A equals not A, you've not just checkmated them, but smashed their king into rubble. To give you a sense of how deeply we as a species hate logical contradictions, back in the 12th century, during a period when Aristotle's logic was being rediscovered in medieval Europe and used by cutting-edge religious thinkers to prove the existence of God, conservatives in church condemned the use of the pagan Aristotle as blasphemy. Part of their complaint was that religious thinkers were using Aristotelian proofs to determine what God was not as part of a process of elimination that they hoped would clarify what the ultimately unknowable deity might be like. No dice, said more conservative clerics, who refused to allow any sort of logic to limit the Almighty in any way. If logic showed that God could not do something or be something, then such logic was wrong and must be rejected. The only exception they made to this rule was a limitation that said God could not create a logical contradiction. In other words, even the most dogmatic thinkers during one of history's most religious eras were not willing to accept a break with consistency, even on behalf of the deity. With regard to rhetoric and argumentation, this human yearning for consistency underlies the most powerful accusation one can hurl at an opponent or their supporters, that of hypocrisy. For while accusing an opponent of being a liar is considered poor form and often rebounds on the accuser, making them come off as ill-tempered and nasty, accusations of hypocrisy almost always leave the accused on the defensive and are thus powerful tools in the politician's rhetorical arsenal. The foundations for accusation of hypocrisy can take many forms, such as the politician who votes against school choice programs while sending his or her own children to expensive private schools, or a finger-wagging, moralizing legislator or preacher caught in an extramarital affair. But inconsistencies can also be subtler or exist in the eye of the beholder of just one person or group. For example, an elected official's failure to, quote, live up to their campaign rhetoric, by voting for something they vowed to vote against during the campaign season, for example, often underlies accusations of dread hypocrisy during the next campaign season, accusations which resonate with voters who tend to look for consistent behavior as a sign of strong character. This need for consistency also underlies many of the cognitive science subjects we've been discussing. For what is confirmation bias if not the preference for information that is consistent with the stories we already are holding in our heads? Our desire for consistency may also underlie other parts of the human makeup. Take humor, for example. Why do we laugh when we're told a joke involving a third guy walking to a bar doing something different than the first two? Possibly because he has refused to act in a consistent manner, which causes us surprise, possibly even discomfort, which we release through laughter. I'll return to the significance of consistency at the end of the podcast. But for now, I think we've talked about it enough to understand how the desire for consistency, and even more importantly, the hatred of inconsistency can inform how candidates might want to prepare for their next encounter. Starting with the Obama campaign, these issues of consistency and inconsistency should chasten those who are urging President Obama to come out swinging in the next debate, as his vice president did in the recent VP debate, or do anything that deviates significantly from the demeanor and forms of behavior we associate with the president, not just from the first debate, but from all the times we've seen him perform in front of a camera audience over the last 4 years. If you remember during the 2000 election, candidate Al Gore suffered when he seemed to change his talking style, level of aggressiveness, and even look between each of the three debates. And this suffering was not just the result of Republicans and stand-up comics mocking his clothing choices and makeup, but rather impacted everyone who watched the debate, supporters and opponents alike. They seemed to not be seeing the same man from one debate to the next, and this level of inconsistency can be jarring, taking its toll on trust, thus lowering a candidate's ethos quotient, since our passion for consistency means we're inherently uncomfortable with someone who comes off as a chameleon. This doesn't mean that the president should wear the same suit and repeat his first debate responses verbatim, which would just be weird. But when he deviates from his previous performances, which he must, he needs to do so subtly and only in a few places. And these deviations should be consistent with other behavior patterns we may be familiar with from his past. For example, during the 2008 campaign, then-candidate Obama seemed much more comfortable using colloquialisms in both formal and informal settings. My favorite being the time he called a journalist who Obama had inadvertently interrupted while the writer was trying to deliver a pickup line to a female member of the news pack, in which the soon-to-be president apologized to the male reporter for, quote, messing with your game. This is a highly humanizing and hilarious moment. While this particular line might not be presidential, there are other casual language tropes the president can draw on, but only once or twice, to remind audiences that he's still the cool guy they liked so much 4 years ago. Beyond navigating this need to change, but again, not too much, and only ways that are consistent with previous behaviors, The president and his advisors also need to be more open to the positives and negatives of their candidate and his administration, at least to the point where they can anticipate criticism that will be leveled against them so they can prepare suitable responses in advance, something the Republican rival did quite well in the first debate. And speaking of Romney, how might consistency work for him? Well, to begin with, a big part of Romney's success during and since the first debate is that he came off as someone comfortable inside his own skin. This is no small thing, since, at least on paper, the Republican candidate seems like exactly the person most Americans don't want to hang out with. Wealthy, straight-laced, kind of stiff, a bit of a moralizer. In other words, he's the type of guy that always gets his comeuppance at the end of every Porky's movie. But once Americans got a good look at him during that first debate, not only did he not seem like the heartless plutocrat they were told he was, which helped to diminish his critics' ethos quotient, by the way, but he did not make any effort to hide who he was. There are no references to popular songs or movies, no use of language or rhetorical devices that don't fit his style and that he never used before. In fact, rather than pretend to be anything other than a man born to success to achieve even greater success, he embraced that persona, but did so with humility, making the case that someone who has been blessed as he has wants to be president so he could pay back for all his good fortune. So in the case of Romney, consistency means continuing to play to, and in fact doubling down on, this narrative. He shouldn't get flummoxed when Obama pulls out a pop culture reference he doesn't understand, and for goodness sake, he shouldn't try to come off as hipper than he actually is. In fact, a self-deprecating joke mocking his own ignorance of pop music or dysfunctionality with Facebook might actually help him. As for preparation, while he did quite well during the first debate anticipating Obama's barbs and having effective retorts at the ready, he should not assume the president will act as predictably in subsequent debates. Debate is as much about strategy as it is about rhetoric, so the prep teams of both candidates need to pull some serious all-nighters, running through every possible scenario of the upcoming verbal jousts, as though they were readying for a championship chess match or military engagement. Well, they should also make sure the candidate gets a good night's sleep before the matchup, especially since, at the end of the day, it is the candidate who wins or loses the election. Okay, so we talked about the debate in the context of logos, pathos, and ethos, argumentation, confirmation bias, and now consistency. So the last thing I want to bring up involves one of the few topics we've not illustrated with debate one yet, media literacy. To be media literate, you need to have some understanding of the culture and motivation behind the news sources you are using to obtain your information. And one of the primary behaviors of media during a dramatic political campaign is they want to highlight that drama. Simply put, a genuine horse race is far more exciting than a slam dunk and tends to draw readers and viewers better as well. It doesn't mean that every media source is making up news in order to drive up their own ratings, but it does mean that they'll be attracted to stories such as the debate aftermath or the latest poll results that imply the election story will be a roller coaster ride between now and election day, so keep watching. Now keep in mind that this election may actually be a nail-biter. And even if it isn't, we're still going to be biting our nails until one candidate gets over the election hump and is declared the winner, first by the media, of course. Even if this year's race ends up being as lopsided a victory as were the 1984, 1996, and 2008 elections. So in terms of critical thinking, just make sure you don't get yourself caught up in other people's hysteria. You've got enough to do between now and election day to keep yourself busy, after all. And fortunately for you, the very next item on your list is going to be to hear from one of the most interesting and passionate people working in the field of rhetoric and argumentation today. Throughout this program, I've turned time and time again to the book Thank You for Arguing, an accessible, informative, and in many instances, hilarious explanation of how the ancient craft of rhetoric impacts every aspect of our contemporary lives. The author of that book is Jay Heinrichs from my neighboring state of New Hampshire. In addition to his books, Jay also travels the country teaching students and companies how they can more effectively communicate using the tools of rhetoric and argumentation. And thanks to the marvels of internet technology, Jay is able to join us from a hotel somewhere in Texas. Jay Heinrichs, welcome to Critical Voter, and tell us a story of how you became the maven of rhetoric.
Well, that's a fun story, at least for me. When I was working at Dartmouth College as an administrator, and frankly was kind of bored in my job, and I found myself spending more and more time wandering through the stacks of the library there, which is a wonderful old library. And one day I found myself in these dark stacks where half the light bulbs didn't work, these fluorescent lights, and the books were covered literally in cobwebs. And it drew my curiosity, what kind of field would this be that nobody has read for so many years? And one book in particular caught my eye, and I brought it down, I opened it up, and it was signed by John Quincy Adams. It had his signature on it. Being kind of a history buff, I thought it was cool that a president of the United States signed this book that I just pulled off the shelf. When I opened it up, I discovered that John Quincy Adams was a professor of rhetoric and oratory at Harvard while he was a United States senator. John Quincy Adams, in his first lecture to these freshmen at Harvard, it was a freshman course, told his students to catch from the relics of ancient oratory those unresisted powers which mold the mind of man to the will of the speaker and yield the guidance of the nation to the dominion of the voice. Which, once you get past that sort of Victorian language, sounded kind of cool, you know, like hypnosis or something. And so I found myself captivated, in part because I'd always wanted to know how words could really work, could get up and do a living for themselves instead of just sitting there looking pretty. So for the next 20 years, I passionately studied rhetoric on my own, talked to rhetoricians across the country, and I wrote Thank You for Arguing. I also created a blog called figurospeech.com. Figure of speech was taken, so it's Figaro Speech. And learned a lot about rhetoric just from the many people who signed on to the blog. I ended up getting 50,000 unique visitors a month and explored language that way. And then I wrote another book after Thank You for Arguing called Word Hero. And Thank You for Arguing has gone on to be published in 7 languages. It succeeded beyond my wildest dreams. It's now considered a bestseller, and I have a new edition coming out next year. So who knew that anything with arguing in a title would actually succeed? I had a friend who said it would sell tens and tens of copies, and it did much better than that.
Well, exciting. I'm looking forward to the new edition. And I've been on Figaro Speech, and I noticed that you've been spending some time looking at the rhetoric of the presidential campaign. And you were talking about highlights and lowlights you'd like to share with us?
Well, plenty of lowlights, as there often is in a presidential campaign. I mean, the fact is, this is not organized oratory, and a campaign shouldn't be. Just to back up, and people think that our leaders used to speak much better than they do now, and that debates used to be much calmer. But if you look at the actual debates that have been recorded, written down, that is, by the ancient Greeks were the worst hecklers in history. You couldn't get out 30 seconds without somebody either throwing a tomato at you or heckling you. And so it's always been kind of a mud fight, presidential campaigns among them. So in terms of the highlights, what's really interesting in a campaign, and this is what people don't look enough at, pundits don't do this enough, they look at the gotchas and the one-liners that comedians worked under the pay of presidential candidates to come up with. But throughout the primaries, as well as in this general election campaign, the big focus of every good piece of rhetoric has to do with defining the opponent's character and defining their own character. So if you look at what happened in this last debate, and I'm sure we'll get into that, what happened was that Obama had managed in the past, mostly through advertising and a really good ground game, to define Romney as this plutocrat out of touch with any real person's reality and very uncaring. And 47% became a household statistic. Then when the debate came on, people saw a different Romney. So it wasn't about what line succeeded or whether who lied and who told the facts and all that. And Aristotle himself said this, the most persuasive tool in rhetoric in any kind of political campaign or argument has to do whether you like and trust the speaker. And that's most important in a presidential campaign. So highlights. One highlight is the advertising campaign that Obama's people ran that defined Romney so well. Another highlight, Romney countering all that great defining that was done in advertising in one evening in a presidential debate in which Romney appeared to be presidential.
I'm just curious, you talked about the different aspects of the debate, and we will get back into that in a minute, but just at a higher level, do you think that Democrats and Republicans tend to use different rhetorical tactics or styles?
Yes. Up until recently, I'd say absolutely. In fact, I made a little bit of a study of this, not a scientific one, but definitely a rhetorical one. I looked at the language of the last 20 years of Democrats and Republicans, including speeches for campaigns, both at the state level and the national level, as well as advertising spots, videos, and even emails as well. And I did find a pattern. And it's actually a pattern I teach to corporations. Democrats tend to want to sound like John F. Kennedy. So they speak in terms of really beautiful patterns of language. They love the beautiful phrasing. So they use what in rhetoric we call figures of speech or schemes, which are patterns of language. And one of the most famous John Kennedy's quotations is a figure of speech called a chiasmus, or the mirror figure, as I call it, in which he said, "Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country," which is a wonderful expression. And that's a figure, it's a pattern, it's organizing words in certain ways or using unusual words in a certain pattern. That's a figure of speech. Now, Republicans, on the other hand, have tended until recently to speak in terms of tropes. And you've heard the word trope, but the most common trope everybody recognizes is the metaphor. So if I say the moon is a balloon, you know that I'm not speaking literally claiming that the moon is a balloon. I'm not lying. I'm making you think about the moon differently, making you think about its similarities to a balloon. I know I'm getting really geeky here, but hear me out. Some tropes are not well known, and so they tend to be more effective because people don't spot the manipulation in them. One great example of the use of a trope by Republicans is when Ronald Reagan was first introducing the subject of welfare reform, and Republicans started talking in terms of the welfare mother or the welfare queen, the woman who had babies just to get more money from the government. Now, whether this ever existed, statistically, it probably existed very little. The important thing is that it defined the subject of welfare in terms of one individual. And that's actually the use of a trope called a synecdoche, in which you take a representative character and you make that person represent an entire phenomenon. Joe the plumber is another example of a synecdoche. I call it a belonging trope because you take something that belongs to something larger and you make it stand for the whole thing. Now, that may sound highly technical and highly theoretical, but what it means in real world terms is that what happens is people start thinking in terms of that one representative, and it sort of makes it seem that much realer. At the same time, when Republicans used tropes, they sounded as if they were talking very simply. So whereas the Democrats are trying to sound like John F. Kennedy, talking very poetically, that didn't sound as believable or as simple, or didn't sound like plain speech. Whereas the Republicans were being at least as manipulative, you just couldn't hear the manipulation because it sounded like plain speech. Now, you can hear this tropes all the time in terms like boots on the ground. In Iraq, we're going to have boots on the ground within 2 months. And it sounded that much realer. Finally, the Democrats began catching on with that kind of language. So when you heard in the stimulus about shovel-ready projects, even though it involved things like the internet, which doesn't involve any shovels, then people started thinking, okay, this stuff is real. We're not just talking about a policy or a concept. So Democrats increasingly in the past few years have started using tropes. And Republicans, interestingly enough, started forgetting what tropes were. So now the Democrats have been able to define Republicans as being one percenters, or having Romney again and again talk about the 47%. Big Bird suddenly represents everything that's going to be cut off in government when Romney becomes president. So those are tropes. No, those are not using fancy language or poetry, but redefining an issue in very simplistic terms that make people think a certain way about the issue.
Jay, if we get back to that first presidential debate, any insight in how the format of the debate might have affected the candidate, and just general thoughts about how well they each performed rhetorically? And then finally, do debates even matter?
Well, let me start with that last question, because I think that's the critical one that helps define the answer to the next. And do debates matter? Well, this one did. And I think the reason is, now, most debates don't. I mean, if you look at how much polls change after presidential debates, most of the time, the so-called winner doesn't get that much of a bump. What seems to influence the outcome of debates rather than the debate itself is interpretation of debate afterward, because obviously most Americans don't tune in. They'll watch the news and they'll look at the clips. So one-liners only go so far. And what these clips do, obviously, is just show the sound bites. The difference here is that there are an unusual number of people tuned into the debates to start with, 20 million, I believe, and that's a high number. And secondly, Romney seemed presidential, and that came off as a surprise to people who had been watching a whole lot of Democratic advertising that had defined Romney as unpresidential. So does the debate matter? Yeah. I mean, Romney went up in the polls, and in a couple of polls, he seems to be leading among likely voters. Is that going to sustain? Well, you know, that's going to be interesting to watch. But I would say that ethos, which is the projected image, is what people think of you and whether they like and trust you, tends to last longer than points scored in a particular kind of argument or debate. So I would think that this could be a really big, very influential first debate. If Romney sustains his performance, it could make all the difference in the election. So in terms of the format, what's interesting to me, and it's, you know, a little hard to tell since they've only done one format, but both of these people are not very good. Romney and Obama, neither is very good at actually being informal. So the town meeting, the informal kind of, you know, audience participation sort of debate, and there's a format that's coming up. I don't know that either one of them does all that well. So Romney, in a way, had an advantage because he got to prepare even more rigorously than Obama. And because it was such a formal kind of debate, Romney got to basically memorize a whole lot of great stuff and get it off. Obama, on the other hand, clearly had not prepared very well, and so he didn't have ready answers for what Romney said.
Just as a learning opportunity, what have you seen during the campaign that you think people can learn, take back with them, and use themselves in a different setting?
Well, I think that's a really good way to put it. How can people take what they learned on the news and apply it to their own lives? And I can tell you, just by learning some of the tools that you teach, it makes these ads turn from completely annoying, you know, these political ads, to something that are entertaining. Look at the devices that these ads are using. Try to think, who are they trying to persuade exactly? Now, one thing that advertisers know really well, and most of us in day-to-day conversation don't pay enough attention to, is who is the persuadable audience? Who's the persuadable audience? And what are you trying to get them to do? Romney's had a difficult position, and it's what's held him back a little bit in his campaign. He has to increase turnout from Republicans. He needs a high voter turnout among Republicans. At the same time, he needs a certain number of independents to swing his way. And he's only had a 4% lead until recently, until this last debate among independents. It's not good enough for him to win the presidency. So he's had to do two things at the same time: swing to the right to increase turnout among Republicans, and seem to be more moderate to appeal to independents. So look at the ads. What are they trying to do? He's trying to do both things at the same time. Look moderate while sending messages to the right. He did it brilliantly in that first debate. And increasingly, the Republicans sort of catching on, oh, we can do this. We can get Republicans enthusiastic while not sounding extreme at the same time. Now, ultimately, though, it's going to come down to ethos. It's going to come down to whether people like or trust a particular candidate and want him to be president. In day-to-day life, that is the most persuadable thing you can do. Don't try to score points in every argument. Think about a relationship and whether you're liked or trusted. Also, think who your real audience is. When you get into an argument with somebody, ask yourself, is there anybody here listening who's remotely persuadable? If not, maybe you need to work on the relationship a little better, or just give up, because you're not gonna solve anything. On the other hand, if people are listening in and there are persuadable people, then you might have a useful argument. So those are the things, you know, you look at a presidential campaign, they're dealing with the same issues.
So Jay, you ended thank you for arguing by arguing that the health of our democracy depends on rediscovering some of that lost art of rhetoric that you discovered in the Dartmouth Library. Care to share your thoughts on that subject as we head into a home stretch? After all, one of these two candidates are gonna win, and then there won't be campaigning anymore. They're gonna have to govern.
I think the problem in terms of our inability to know the tools of rhetoric is that when we don't know them, we're that much more easily manipulated. And what that allows is the advertising, the most manipulative, worst, nasty political advertising that a few very rich people get to pay for, actually could end up buying elections. And by the way, some of these people might even be with foreign governments. So it's not the money that's the problem. It's what this money buys. And what it buys is manipulation. If we know the tools, we're that much less manipulated. I think the future of our democracy depends on this. At the same time, the founders believed, and this is Alexander Hamilton who said this, not me, that what Congress needs is a few impartial arbiters, as he called it, highly persuasive, educated people who can serve as the swing vote in Congress, as the moderates with the swing vote. We put together a system in part because we don't understand these tools that make it so that only the extremes now are getting elected to Congress. We need to do everything we can to create a rhetorically advantageous sort of system, which our founders wanted, and understand the tools ourselves so that these most manipulative kinds of arguments or advertising won't affect us as much, so that the persuadable voters are the most qualified, not the most easily swayed through manipulation.
Okay, I think with that we'll wrap up, but I just wanted to thank you for joining us, and I'll give you the last word.
Thank you, John. I really appreciate what you're doing. You know, when I speak to college audiences, which I often do, I look out over the crowd, and it is a rhetorical device that I use, but I mean it too. I say there may be only one of you who really gets what I'm saying and takes it to heart. Maybe that's all we need. So I hope there's one listener among you who dedicates his or her life to this cause. It's an important one, and I appreciate what you've done with it.
Okay, thanks. I think I'd be happy with just one listener. That was Jay Heinrichs, author of Thank You for Arguing and Word Hero, and the man behind the rhetoric blog Figaro Speech, a link to which can be found on the Critical Voter Resources page. So before telling you about next week's guest, I want to say a few more things about the notion of consistency. As I mentioned earlier, one of the deadliest accusations you could level at an opponent is that they have behaved hypocritically, that is, in an inconsistent manner, by, for example, doing something after being elected that seems to contradict campaign promises or previous voting patterns. When we talk about this sort of political decision-making, we're getting into complicated territory, since campaign promises can be vague and open to interpretation, and legislation is often the result of compromise between competing goods, meaning a perceived inconsistency may be the result of incomplete information, changing circumstances, or our own oversimplified and sometimes self-serving interpretation of what was actually promised. I would also assert that our drive to see consistency in leaders, especially those whom we support, and inconsistency, hypocrisy in others, especially those we don't support, also taps into discomfort with our own inconsistent behavior. These internal contradictions might include ignoring the homeless person asking for a handout, despite our own self-identification as being generous and caring, or cutting corners at work, despite our belief in our own dedication and commitment. In other words, we seem to be looking for a political leader to demonstrate a level of consistency that we instinctively know firsthand is not possible by a member of the human species. This inconsistency in our own desire for consistency is even more complicated, since anyone who has risen to the level of being able to run for president has no doubt had to make compromises along the way that the rest of us never have to confront. Now, partisan voter has a simple solution to this problem, ignoring inconsistencies that can lead to accusations of hypocrisy on the part of candidates they like, but highlighting and dwelling on similar inconsistency or hypocrisy on the part of those they dislike. This is what underlies all those spam emails you've probably been getting with titles such as Obama the Flip-Flopper or What Does Mitt Romney Believe Today?, each of which is designed to tap into our all-too-human hatred of contradiction coupled with partisan confirmation bias. But as critical thinkers, we're obliged to recognize from firsthand experience that any human being is made up of multiple interests, desires, and motivations, which can legitimately be in conflict without rising to a level of hypocrisy that would imply a significant character flaw. We must also recognize that the political process, which is ultimately about compromise between different opinions, many of which represent competing goods, means that absolute consistency is not possible and may not even be desirable for a candidate who must lead a nation of 300 million plus people who neither individually or collectively represent a single or consistent set of beliefs. And on that philosophical note, I'd like to make a philosophical announcement. I suspect that many listeners are fans of The Stone, an online column appearing in the New York Times that includes the writing of philosophers talking about timeless issues and contemporary events. As you might expect, a number of pieces running in The Stone this year have touched on this year's election, and I'm delighted to say that Professor Simon Critchley, moderator for the Times Stone series, will be joining us next week to talk about how ancient and modern thinkers can help us make sense of life, the election, and everything. So join us next time on a Don't Miss Critical Voter Podcast.